I want to say that I do appreciate the opportunity. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Ann Smith, I am here on behalf of the Board of Administrative Oversight. As one of your appointees, I am vice chair of that board and have been asked to come and provide that board's input on this question of costs and fees and their assessment. The board began looking at this issue in spring of 2004 at this court's request. This was not an issue brought to our attention by OLR, by respondents, or by any of the other constituents of the system. We've reviewed the court's decision in the Connor case, other decisions by the court that address fees and costs. We've reviewed the issues with Director Saleen, the same statistics recited by the Chief Justice in her concurrence in the Connor case. We met with and we engaged in what I might characterize as spirited discussions with the Lawyer Regulation Study Committee about some of the issues that are raised. And, of course, included in, on that study committee are a number of lawyers who represent respondents in these proceedings and would have the respondents' position in mind as they're talking about discipline matters and imposition of costs. We've also consulted with other OLR staff, including Counsel Weigel, who you heard earlier today. We discussed this, I think, at every meeting from spring 2004 that the board had through the last meeting that we had in September. You've had the benefit of our discussions if you've read the minutes from those meetings, because they're fairly thorough minutes. And at our meeting on June 3rd, we as a board took a vote on the petition that you have in front of you. And we voted at that time to endorse continued assessment of costs and attorney's fees to respondents that have been found to have violated the SCR rules, as this court has done in the past, pursuant to SCR 22.24, pursuant to your existing rule. But we also voted to encourage the director and his staff to negotiate fees prior to the submission of fees and costs to this court. Then, if no agreement would be able to be reached, we would encourage the director to seek recovery of full costs, as he does at this time. Now, I want you to understand that the board vote, I will remind you of this, was a 5-4 vote with two of our members absent. My speculation is if those two members had been there, we still would have been one vote apart from each other. Different members of the board expressed varying reasons for either supporting or opposing the position that the board took. And at some points, they were diametrically opposed reasons for either supporting or opposing. So I find myself in an interesting situation. Normally, when I appear before you, I know exactly what my position is. I have one way to argue it. I don't have to worry about being balanced on different sides of the issue. And I got to tell you, that's a lot easier than this job that I have here today and this job, which seems a bit more like what you have to do in terms of balancing the different positions. So I'm not able to be an advocate for any particular thing. I'm all over the place, and when I get to the end of my comments, I'm going to tell you why I think that happened. I will give you just a quick summary of the varying opinions that came through in the discussion that the board had. I would say they are generally broken down into three categories. One is the who should pay category. One is the burden on the system category. And the final one would be the fairness category of comments. Obviously, we've got a self-funded system funded by those who are regulated by it, and we get money both from the general population of lawyers, and we also get money from those who are disciplined in different proportions. Some of our board members felt very strongly that this was a very fair allocation of who should pay and how the cost should be financed, that those who do violate the rules and are found to have violated the rules should pay a disproportionate cost of the financing of the system. There were other board members, though, who felt that this source of funds issue really ought to be put to those who pay for it. Ask the lawyers, which, of course, we know has now been done. At least some of the lawyers have been asked through the bar bench survey, and we're just waiting to see what the results of that particular survey sample would be. In the burden on the system category, I would say that some of the things that came through in our discussion there was that the board was under the impression that it was in a relatively small number of cases that respondents raised significant objections to the proposed cost assessment, and in only a few cases have those costs in fact been reduced. Now, that can be explained by a number of factors, but that was something that the board took into consideration. The board had significant concerns about changes to the system that would result in the use of resources not on substantive issues of whether a lawyer has done wrong, whether the public is protected, but rather on this side issue, in our estimation, to some extent, of costs and fees, and primarily it seems to be an issue of the attorney's costs and fees that are driving the discussion. And finally, we did look at the state bar proposal, had these very spirited discussions with the state bar proposal, and the concern that came through from many of my board members was that the state bar proposal or any proposal that results in significantly increased staff time and OLR resources litigating and resolving attorney's fees as an issue separate and apart from the discipline issues, the potential rule violation issues, is really a diversion of the resources and time away from the activities that we think are most important and most focused on protecting the public's interest, which is the thing that we came back to over and over again as a board. The fairness to the respondent issue, though, was a tough one to wrangle with. The cases expressed concern. The state bar proposal clearly incorporates some criteria, some ways to measure and accommodate and create a sense of fairness for the respondent who's going to be hit with these costs and have to deal with paying these costs, particularly in the event of a suspension, otherwise trying to get their right to practice law and to make their livelihood the way they're used to doing it back. We heard some issues relating to overcharging, over-lawyering. We heard about the idea of raising stakes, lowering stakes. The board is not at all interested, and let me make this very clear, in supporting a system that's viewed as unfair, in supporting a system that looks like a witch hunt against any of the lawyers who end up being respondents and are accused of violating the rules. But the process and the results suggested to us that this is not necessarily a problem that's solved by some of the suggested modifications to the cost allocations that are already in place, or perhaps more importantly, to a change in the language of the rule that you're already working under. The court's already created a system where OLR can prosecute only the violations that the preliminary review committee finds cause to proceed on. So in terms of an overcharging issue, you have already built into the system several stops along the way, pieces of review along the way, so that we don't have unfettered OLR discretion without a substantial amount of review. In the past 5 years, we understand that misconduct was found on all counts in 85% of the disciplinary cases, and misconduct was found in all counts in 78% of the contested disciplinary cases. So the flip side of this is, you're not rubber stamping things as a court. Yes, there's discretion and there's some stops built into the system, but there's clearly a good amount of review, of proof, of work done by all parties and all sides to make sure that there is a fair hearing for those who are involved in the system. And ultimately, of course, from our standpoint, a fair result that protects the public. In terms of the amount of the fees that end up getting charged, because again, it seems to be that the attorney's fees issue is the one that seems to raise the most questions, the prosecution costs are well below a market rate at $60 an hour. I don't think anybody really disagrees with that. We've not done a survey on this, but many of us on the board have substantial civil and criminal litigation experience. And it seems to us, as we've looked at the same statistics you have about how the fees have come out on various cases, what the averages have been, that these fees that have been assessed over the last number of years are not substantial in comparison to the cost of a party in a typical civil matter or cost to the defendant in a typical criminal matter. Again, this is really based on a lot of the experience that many of us bring to the board as we sit there. We did have some concern, and this is a little bit broader based than just a concern relating to the fees. Something that you discussed a little earlier here today, a practice of not conducting what those of us sitting on the board tend to think of as plea bargaining by OLR. We understand OLR is given its direction by the Preliminary Review Committee, and it is OLR's understanding that the concept of plea bargaining with regard to the level of charges, number of charges, and that type of thing is just not something that's built into their system and, in fact, would be discouraged by the way that the system has been set up. And that, you know, we think has some limiting factors, which as a board we haven't fully vetted. But at least as you can see from the motion that was passed by the board with regard to costs, we think there's got to be some discussion and negotiation so that it isn't an all-or-nothing thing, but not necessarily something that would rise to the level of the kind of thing that's being suggested by the state bar, requiring additional hearings, additional submission of evidence, more of a discussion among the parties and an attempt to resolve this.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
One of the defects on plea bargaining, plea agreements that's often done is that it forces a defendant who is not necessarily guilty and who might, given a trial, turn out to be acquitted, but it forces the defendant not to take the chance.
Yes.
Because if you go to trial on a larger charge, you might get convicted of that too. Innocent or not, you might get convicted. Therefore, it's better to take the lesser charge, and putting it in OLR terms, the lesser charge and a public reprimand, than the greater charge and a potential of 5 years revocation or suspension, whatever you want to call it. And that's why the court didn't put in the rules, no plea agreements, because the pressure on the defendant increases to plead guilty. That's why it's there. Now, if you put negotiations in at fees, to what extent is that going to then lop over so somebody says, look, I'm willing to take a public reprimand that was 5 months, but not six, because that'll cost me more time to get back in. So I'll take no, so we won't have a trial. We won't go to the referee. And you won't charge me full freight. Do you know what I'm trying to say? I mean, I want to know whether it's not going to slip into the first part, rather than just be limited to the second stage.
A slippery slope argument.
Well, I don't know if it's a slope. It's a slippery something. Read an article that says, don't worry about the slippery slope. Just deal with the issue before you. You'll take care of the slope when you hit it.
You know, I think that is great advice.
I did, too. That's why I remembered it. I don't usually remember things I don't agree with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think from the board standpoint, we weren't ready to have a full-blown discussion about the plea issue. It just seemed ironic to a number of people that sit on the board that when you do have something like imprisonment looming, the system allows you to do this. Not that licensure is not a very, very important thing, but it's not liberty versus non-liberty.
But that's what
it seemed interesting to us that in this system there were almost, in some regards, more protections or more limitations built in.
Yeah, that's why on plea agreements. And the system, theoretically, although there's a dispute about that, needs plea agreements in order to handle volume. I mean, that's the theory. Well, we don't have that problem here.
Yes, right? That's true. We don't have the same
and
level.
And so everybody, and that goes back to plea agreements, goes back to the concept of the pressure on the respondent with fees. That's the big argument. You're putting the pressure on for fees, you're going to force him to plead guilty. And you don't want to do that. So if you don't want to do that pressure with fees, then you don't want to miss. That's why putting in plea agreements just puts the pressure at a different level.
Yes.
Your statement is really very good, and I'm sorry to have interrupted, but I did want to explain at least my understanding. It doesn't have to be the court's understanding of this.
It's helpful for the next time we discuss this as a board.
If I could, Ms. Smith, though, if I could follow up on the Chief's concern and question. The other side of the coin is that by having a system that where we all are ostensibly in agreement that there's a concern about someone pleading guilty who may in fact not be guilty because of the ramifications, the system, as we heard argued this morning by, I believe, Mr. Schneiderman, forces a person to go ahead and accept or accept the consequences to avoid the increase of costs.
Yes.
Under the system that is currently in place that you are proposing that we continue. Aren't we still sliding into that first area with the current system?
We are, and I think it is telling how many of the respondents do represent themselves pro se. One of the discussions that we had as a board was, is it really the cost shifting of the relatively modest costs of the OLR, at least in terms of hourly rate, compared to the costs of a respondent hiring their own counsel in the first place? Look at how few of them do it. Now they may feel, well, I'm a lawyer, I can defend myself, I don't need this. Could be. But, you know, we suspect and we're told by a number of the folks that represent respondents that the whole issue of having to hire their own counsel is as much of a deterrent to the kind of defense that they might put on with that counsel in place. And maybe more so in terms of how they decide to proceed than worrying about whether there's going to be some cost shifting at the end of a few thousand dollars. So for us, it was difficult to figure out exactly where the pressure is coming from. Is it coming from the cost shifting issue? Are people agreeing to be disciplined because they don't want to hire their own counsel? Forget the cost shifting. I mean, there's all kinds of costs involved in this that are not the OLR costs that these respondents are probably thinking about when they decide what strategy they're going to use to defend themselves, whether they're going to defend themselves or what they're going to do in these situations.
Ms. Smith, let me ask one other follow-up question from this morning. From Mr. Schneidman's comments, you pointed out in your intro that we already have a rule that allows for discretion, 22.24 sub 1. Mr. Schneidman's comments, as I recall, and I'm paraphrasing, so I hope I'm not stating it inaccurately, was that, in effect, what we've done is we're not exercising that discretion. We have created a de facto fee-shifting rule. So that seems to, there seems to be a disagreement between the two of you in terms of how we have exercised our discretion under the current rule. I don't know if you have a comment with respect to...
My personal comment on that is that I agree with him. I agree that you have a rule that gives you the kind of discretion that you are would be receiving, for example, under the state bar's formulation, albeit they're putting that onto the a different level of decision maker than you. And you've read enough transcripts from the board to know that my phrase on this is always a solution in search of a problem, because in terms of how the rule is formulated, you have a rule that allows you to choose any criteria that you think is important in balancing what I think are the factors that end up putting a lot of good thinking, reasonable and bright people at all different points along this continuum.
Counselor, isn't it possible that sometimes we don't have the facts developed for us to, in any meaningful way, apply any kind of criteria to what the costs are? We know factually what they are, but we don't know anything about any of the equitable factors that may bear upon whether all the costs should be assessed, except we know, of course, what charges were approved and what were not.
Yes. And
but
I,
we don't know anything about ability to pay or any of the circumstances that led up to any concerns about payment.
Correct. And I think about it, Your Honor, in terms of the fee-shifting statutes that I am familiar with in my practice. I do a lot of work in the bankruptcy area. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of work in Section 1983 cases that have fee-shifting provisions in them. So there aren't necessarily a set of judicially created rules as rules. What there are is a development of case law saying if we're going to award fees in this fee-shifting context, we're going to apply the lodestar, or we're going to, you know, whatever the, in the bankruptcy world, it's the Johnson case factors. So I agree that instead of just having 22.24 sitting there, which gives you the ability to, you know, unless you take the next step and get to the point of either modifying that rule to be more specific, which is what I think the state bar proposal is, or as a group through decisions you develop that, there is a bit of guesswork.
Yeah, well, we don't have an idea about ability to pay, except we know that when we discipline a lawyer, sometimes we take away his or her livelihood, so certainly that's going to affect ability to pay, but we don't know anything about the person's independent ability to pay.
That's right, and ability to pay isn't just a factual issue either. In some regards, I would consider that to be a policy issue. Should a wrongdoer, who is a wrongdoer, but is in worse financial condition than a wrongdoer who is in better financial condition, but has done the same thing wrong, when you have basically equivalent kinds of wrongdoing, should one have less of a price to pay for that into the system because of financial circumstances, as opposed to penalizing somebody who may have been more successful for one reason or another?
Well,
could be their family circumstances, not just, you know, the
You also want to look at not giving someone an obligation that he or she really is unable to shoulder. We do that all the time in criminal cases with restitution. There has to be some showing when it's not been paid and that there was an ability to pay it. And
right, which I think you have already written into the reinstatement rules.
Yeah, I know. I understand that. Well, that's fine. Enough said. I think you understand what concerns me.
Okay. I think that those of us, especially who have litigated under fee-shifting statutes, are keenly aware of the difficulty of trying to tie certain legal work and costs to a claim when you have a multi-claim kind of case, various claims sharing the same facts and theories. It's a terribly laborious and sometimes really an artificial process to try and adequately allocate in that way. It certainly could be done, but I think that it would be fair to express the board's concern about something like that, about whether it can be done without compromising very important efficiencies and resources that would better be spent on the public protection aspects of the system. We've talked about how the language of the rule already gives you discretion, which you may or may not have exercised at least as a group to make these decisions. And certainly there's nothing stopping you from determining what these guidelines ought to be if you want to adopt some that are proposed by the state bar, by some of the other jurisdictions you've looked at. I think the other thing we took note of is that it could be harmful to have a sort of continued set of discussions coming from the court and a continued set of opinions from the court without some kind of a voice that ends up being somewhat of a consensus on what you're looking for. Because after a while, it does look as if when you read opinions that constantly talk about developing standards on the cost side of things, that there's something terribly wrong and unfair with the system in general, that OLR just can't get it right time after time after time when they come to you. And so I think the board has some concern about the appearance of the fairness of the system if there isn't some kind of more specified set of criteria or a different system like the petition that's already been presented to you by Director Saleem, but which I'm not here to support because
you don't have the votes. You don't have the votes.
That's right. I don't have the votes. We did as a board.
Personally, don't agree with it, I gather.
No, actually, I think that you have the ability under your rules, and I think that it would be a good thing for you to sit down with the input that you've received and exercise your discretion to come up with a set of criteria that people will understand and can move forward with. I'm not particularly enamored with the idea that it has to be incorporated in a modification of the rule at all. I understand that you would prefer from a time and many other aspect, perspective, to perhaps have this work done by those who are at the decision-making level below you so that you can be a review court. There may be something to be said for that because of the distance that you have from some of the details of this. On the other hand, I have confidence that you could set a criteria and you could actually make those determinations personally.
You'd prefer to keep it at the court with criteria.
I would, because I think that that gives you the flexibility you need, really, to do what we tried very hard to do and what I think caused this dispersion of votes on this issue on my board and why you're hearing varying opinions here. We look very seriously at the duties that we had as a board that you've set out for us to monitor fairness, productivity, effectiveness, and efficiency of the attorney regulation system, and to have all of those things be encompassed in the system without necessarily having one of them taking precedence against the other one. The board's vote and discussion, I think, took those factors into account and concluded on the whole that the system as it stands now is a fair allocation of funding of the system between those found to have committed the violations and being required to pay more to support the system. And there's always examples where things could be perceived to have gone awry. And your existing rule gives you the opportunity to correct that situation and to deal with that situation if something has gone awry. We think the system is set up to advance fairness already in terms of charging decisions because of some of the stops that already exist. Keith does not have the ability as executive director to run willy-nilly off with whatever he wants to in terms of charges against someone. He has to have that reviewed by a board, and sometimes it's reviewed more than once before it goes somewhere. And we think that, in essence, our board believes that there's relatively low cost of conducting this litigation from the standpoint of a market rate, and you've already got discretion, as I said, to make these corrections. Modification to a system that brings in more hearings, more discretion, more levels of review of costs and fees, we felt as a board, would have a very negative impact on productivity and efficiency of the system, and that the modification of the existing method of allocating fees and costs would not increase the fairness and effectiveness on the one hand of the system in a way that was substantial enough to justify those modifications and perhaps lead to these additional costs, additional hearings, this additional process. I think it's difficult to design a system that meets all those needs of fairness, productivity, efficiency, effectiveness. You know, it's a balance. Any time that you're more efficient and you're more certain, then in the minds of some, you may be less fair because you're not able to adapt to individual circumstances. So in the end, you're going to need to have to try and find the balance just as we did as a board. And we thought on balance that the rule you have in place is one that allows you to balance those different factors, take into account when things go awry in a particular matter or seem unusual, and adjust to those. I think one of the things that intrigued us, but we did not fully vet this to the point of voting on it, was the concept of a system that had charges attached to it. I don't know if you want to think of them as fines or assessments that we were talking about earlier, because one thing that came through from the board members was that if you had what became our shorthand of bad actor, if you have a bad actor, someone who really has violated rules and done harm, then there's nothing wrong with asking that bad actor to pay a disproportionate amount of the costs of the system that we use in order to find those folks and make sure that we remove them from places where they can hurt the public. But on balance, this was where our board came out. It was not a, you know, we weren't zeroing in. We don't have a rocket going to a particular target, but we had some vigorous debates and I think thoughtful discussion about the fact that you balance all the factors that you at least have told us is our job to balance as a board.
Ms. Smith, I want to thank you for your appearance and good comments, and thank the board for its lengthy and interesting discussion. And I hope you will convey that message to the board, and I hope you will also, since you expressed concern as to whether the court had, as a result of this discussion on costs, any significant issues, problems, concerns about the administration of the system. I hope you will convey to the board Justice Prosser's comments, with which the court happily concurs. And we'll meet with the board later on in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have December. We have all elements except...
Okay, except us. Is that right? Well, thank you very much for your appearance, Justice Prosser.
I took from your testimony that a majority of the board is happy with the discretion that the court presently has to review these fees. I also heard a suggestion about possible discussions between OLR and a respondent.
Yes.
But I don't think I heard, and maybe I just wasn't listening attentively enough, exactly what factors you think the court should utilize in exercising its discretion.
We don't have a list of factors for you, Your Honor.
Well, with all possible respect, the court has not been willing to exercise any discretion. I don't think I can think of more than one case where we've ever reduced the costs 100%.
That's my understanding as well, Your Honor, that this is not a situation where the majority of the court felt that there was something so wrong with what was presented to it that it needed to exercise its discretion in a way to change this.
Well, then really, you're perfectly satisfied with the status quo.
My direction to you was to indicate that the board has voted by majority vote in favor of maintaining the status quo, which is 22.24, which gives you discretion.
And I to put it bluntly, I took from your testimony that the board would like for me to shut up.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that that would be a fair assessment. I think that we do have concerns that in the event there's going to be continued discussion about this, it's important from our standpoint that the system look as if it's treating people fairly. So if it is not, then we need to fix that. Our board is of the opinion that we're not seeing anything that suggests that there is a systemic problem that would require a rule change to make the system more fair to the respondents than it already is.
Ms. Smith, if I could state it in perhaps a slightly different way than Justice Prosser did. I heard you say on the one hand that the board is satisfied with the status quo, and included in that is the fact that the court already has the discretion to act. I also heard you comment when I asked you about Mr. Schneidman's position earlier in terms of whether or not the court was in fact exercising the discretion in the way that would be envisioned, that you tended to agree with his observation that we weren't. And so it kind of puts us in a difficult quandary because under the rule we have an obligation to exercise discretion. And it's how we exercise that discretion, whether it's under the current rule or proposed change rule, or if we choose to adopt Mr. Saleen's position and not exercise discretion at all, I think is the issue. But if the issue is one of fairness, I don't know how a court, when it has a duty to exercise discretion, cannot indeed go through some form of exercise. And if that means that the court is respectfully in disagreement on a point, do we not have an obligation to put that disagreement out so that the litigants have an opportunity to see what's going on within the court?
Yes, you do. And I guess when I when I talk about what the discretion that you have in 2224, I mean, you're making decisions, so we can't say you're not exercising discretion, because you're making
decisions.
Discretion
is not the same thing as decision making. The court has already said that.
Okay.
Some great jurist wrote that in an opinion. I can't remember what her name is, but I know she lives in Wausau. So,
so there, you know, and the discretion that I guess, well, the decisions that I think that we've seen you make is that generally you are assessing full costs with very few limited exceptions. One, I think that's right, Justice Prosser, there may be one where that was not the ultimate decision by the court. And so, you know, we as a board are not dissatisfied with that method.
In other words.
But if you want to inject some more factors into it, like, you know, it isn't going to be all or nothing. We may look at these other things. The board isn't telling you we're opposed to that. If you want to develop that in your decisions, we don't see the need for a change in the rules. And our concern, first and foremost, is that we not create a whole other set of litigation over the cost of the system when the primary purpose of the system is supposed to be to protect the public.
And let me ask you about that, Ms. Smith, because I'm very curious. I want to relate your comments and the board's position to the position that I heard advocated by the bar. What I understand the bar's position to be is, yeah, there's some factors, we can tinker around with them, that we think are synonymous with discretion and decision-making process. And what we're asking the process to do is have those factors considered by the referee and by the people that are closest to what's going on a daily basis, and then submit that recommendation to you so that you can exercise your discretion, as opposed to having the court exercise its discretion based on a recommendation of full costs without the benefit of that analysis. What's wrong with that?
Our concern is that that adds another whole piece of mini litigation, essentially, to the referee process. And I don't think the board was convinced that doing that would have sufficient benefit to put the resources, the time, the effort that our OLR staff and hired outside counsel would have to put into that for the benefit, whatever that might be, that someone would want with a discretionary system.
But if I could paraphrase a comment from Justice Bradley earlier, that then puts this court in the untenable position of having to go through that analysis without information. If we don't have the recommendation, if it's not been developed below, yet we have the obligation to make the determination, under what facts and circumstances can we reach a just conclusion or a resolution of the issue before us? That, I think that's the problem. Maybe I'm misstating, and I don't mean to speak for Justice Bradley, but I think that is the concern of some members of this court. Is at what point do you inject and start making decisions if you don't really have enough information to alter the recommendations that are coming below? And if the recommendation coming from below is always full cost, then how do we go through our decision-making process at this level? That's the concern. I'm not asking for you for an answer. I don't think that'd be fair to you, but I think that's what's troubling
the
majority of the court.
And I guess my understanding is that as it stands now, the respondent makes known to you whatever the respondent's concerns are regarding the decision.
Let me put it into our processes. We get the material, including the costs. The assumption, I don't want to get into presumptions because I don't want to deal with it on that kind of level, but the assumption is if you're guilty of something, that is, you're found to have violated it, the assumption is you're going to pay full cost. And my hearing from the board and reading the board is, on its face, that's generally fair.
Correct.
That there are occasions where, for one reason or other, it may not look fair, but that we should operate on the general assumption it is fair. When it turns out that the court is concerned about the fairness, the court then should get additional material on the costs, and through that system develop and apply criteria
distinguishing these, quote, unfair cases from the general mill. And that's how I hear you saying we should proceed.
Yes, because that's our understanding of what the rule allows you to do at
that's
this point.
Right. And so you would say, okay, look at these, quote, special cases, and treat them as special cases, and develop the criteria. I hear you saying don't submit it to the referee because that opens up the costs in every case, and then you have this extra special litigation.
Yes.
Therefore, you, although you look as if you're stating the status quo, you're saying that what you add to this status quo is a concept that you will deviate, and you should, if you want to, start deviating. But when you deviate, let's think about the totality, that is, criteria using, so with the courts consistent, and for the reasons set forth by Justice Robensack and Justice Butler, we don't generally have enough on the first round, so we then have to decide what kind of information we want from the parties to deviate from the general rule, or at that time, we can send it back to the referee. But what you have done in your proposal is not engraft a cost system that encourages all lawyers, all respondents to say, not me.
Correct.
Do I understand your statement?
Yes.
That's the way I heard it. That's the way I understand it. I'm trying to put it into our processes from the judge's view, and I may have been eminently unsuccessful, but at least I understand it. Any other comments or questions? I repeat, Ms. Smith, thank you. Thank the board, and we shall see you all in whenever it's scheduled. And please send a summary, as you see it, to the board of both what you said as well as the general statements here, including those of the court thanking Mr. Celine, and thank the board. You got a tremendous job. We knew that when you got it. And one of the things that does concern the court is we put in a process that has measures at every step to protect the public, the grievant, and protect the lawyer. This has more process than anything else I can think of. And one of the concerns about the system, which after it's been in effect for a while, is we should look at that and see, are there steps that should be added, or are there steps that should be changed? Because it is a very step oriented process put in because we didn't have enough steps the last time. So, you know, the pendulum swings.
Yes.
And we hope we didn't hit the AOB with the pendulum as it's swinging. Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Schweitzer.
Honorable Justices, especially the illustrious Chief Justice.
Thank you. I accept that.
I'm John Nicholas Schweitzer. I was on the OLR study committee that developed the bar's proposed rule. Before the lunch break, I had pared my presentation down to, I think, about 60 seconds if you didn't ask me any questions, but I'll be a little bit more expansive, maybe two.
But don't feel you have to.
I think Warren Wood did a fine job of presenting and supporting the proposal. I'm not really talking about it in detail. I really just added myself as a speaker because I heard a few of the court's specific questions and concerns, and I would like to address some of them partly through what we went through in developing the proposal. I'll dispense with my lengthy summary of all of the court's decisions. I'm sure you won't mind that. But after these details, then I would just like to make one brief summary comment about why I think the proposal is the better one. Justice Abramson, you asked about the Alaska list of factors. And although we do not repeat much of the language in there verbatim, including the words vexatious, etc., we referred to that over and over to try to make sure that we were considering the same factors. Mm-hmm. We felt that by putting a phrase in such as the reasonable costs of the proceeding or the cooperativeness or cooperation, that we were covering the same. We felt we covered them. If you feel we've left something out, I'm sure that could be added with no concern. Justice Butler, you asked about the imposition of costs at the beginning rather than at the end, and I share your concern. I'm a referee. Mm-hmm. And in at least one case, a respondent who had very meager financial resources, I recommended that less than full costs be imposed because paying back the costs of the investigation would be an independent bar to that person getting reinstated. And that's slightly different from asking the court for reconsideration at the time of reinstatement. Justice Bradley, you asked about you actually remembered a phrase that Mr. Sleen did not, but somewhere I heard that nature of the misconduct instead of the severity of the counts. And I thought Mr. Sleen had proposed it, and I thought it was better language also.
It's in a September 27, 2005 letter. But
it was a change that came in after we had presented the most recent proposal. I think it's improved language. Justice Prosser, you asked about the clear, satisfactory, and convincing standard, I believe. And that actually touches on what could be a much larger subject. The OLR, in one of our discussions with Keith, was willing to accept that burden. I agree it needn't have been that high, although that's the standard they have to meet for the discipline itself. But OLR was willing to accept that increased burden partly in order to ensure the fairness of the process and to avoid perhaps an interest by respondents in discovery and mini hearings. And he basically said, we don't want that, but in return I feel sure enough about our process that we'd accept the higher burden. I hope I haven't misstated that, but I mean, there's a little history to why we have that higher burden. And that actually goes to Justice Robinsack's, I think, one of your recent comment. You touched on an important point where you said you don't have the facts. And in Ms. Smith's response, she said, well, we might get involved in mini hearings, I think, and in extending the proceedings. And we did not want, in creating a rule like this, to create mini hearings, to create hearings on costs, to open up discovery, to have hearings, et cetera. And so the rule as crafted avoids discovery and hearings, but it does create a little extra protection for the respondent in that extra burden of proof, et cetera. Also, Ms. Smith's response to your comment, Justice Robinsack, in which she started to say, well, a person with fewer financial resources should not have fewer costs imposed on them than a person with more financial resources if they committed the same offense. Well, that's exactly the sort of argument that I think could go to a referee. And I think one of the things we're talking about here is having an opportunity to talk about the fairness of costs in every case, and that can be done at the referee level. I mean, you would get that recommendation, you would get that opportunity to argue, and you as a reviewing court could decide what to do with it. Those are my detailed comments, but I'll just say as a referee myself, I consider the bar's proposal to be the better solution to the concerns that brought us here today. The court clearly has the discretion now in its rule to impose all or a portion of the cost of litigation. What we see is that you are wrestling with how to exercise that discretion. It is my understanding that the court is seeking fairness in these hearings, and it's my opinion that it's more likely to find fairness in flexibility rather than in uniformity, which is you've been following a uniform rule, and you always find that there are problems with it. With flexibility, you have a little bit more work to do, as the referees will have a lot more work to do. But it's a better way to achieve fairness if that's your
goal. How many more hours per case do you think you'd spend?
as referee?
I have never had a case, of course, in which we explicitly had arguments on costs because the assumption
was
that
I know, but you've got other...
But I would assume that it's without discovery and without designating a portion of the hearing on costs, we would probably have an extra couple of hours.
What do you mean without discovery?
Without either side being able to ask its opponent for more detailed records than they choose to submit in the rule as proposed. Let me just explain that for a second. The way we have written it is that OLR must submit its costs.
Right. It does now.
It does now.
And it has a short description.
And what Keith has accepted is that if that brief discussion of costs does not sufficiently support the request by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence, then he doesn't get them.
Yeah, but look, they submit 30 pages detailed per day, per minute, with a rough description of what they did, right?
Actually, I don't see those costs. They don't come to me now.
All right. That's what they do. Just like good bills of private counsel. So that is clear and convincing unless it's challenged. So I don't understand what you're saying.
Let me try to answer it, but coming from a totally different direction, which is that I do believe I am in the position, having heard a case, of having an idea of which charges were more serious, which were more minor, which were well proven, which were not proven, which had evidence that was clearly supported by extensive witnesses or documents, which ones were simply, I won't say there were ever anything supported by hearsay evidence, but in other words, I would not make my initial assessment on costs based on looking at the cost breakdown. I would say something like 3 out of the 5 counts were proven. They were the 3 most serious counts. I think this person should pay 90% of the costs.
Where did you get 90% from?
Excuse me?
Where did you get 90% from?
Out of my head.
Well, that's my point.
I know. But out of my feeling for how much work had been presented to me.
Well, Mr. Schweitzer, you're an administrative law judge, aren't you?
Yes, ma'am.
You don't write in your decisions on the basis of my feelings it's 90%. You'd have to write on the basis of looking at this, it's 90%, because the 3 charges that were dismissed involved the same facts and the same legal analysis. Therefore, I'm going to give you 0 for those dismissed counts, because they roughly fall within the not dismissed case counts, or you're going to come to 90% on some rational basis, or you're going to be overturned, because it'll look like an erroneous exercise of discretion.
I quite accept that, and apologize if I was being too cavalier in my previous answer, but I would, as I said, if there were 3 counts out of 5 were proven, the 3 were the more important, I would try to quantify how much more effort.
It's going to take you more than looking at the at his statements. Because he's not going to tell you when he spent time on which counts, because it's very hard to keep track that way until maybe the very end. And so you're going to have what you call this discovery. That's where I'm really getting at. You're not going to be able to do it in 2 hours without a hearing if he's challenged. And if you're saying you're going to not accept that as prima facie, then you're going to have a hearing in all the cases.
If that's where it leads, I think I'd probably recommend against going in that direction. But an alternative, which would be to have this court attempt to make those, you know, decisions, is going to be just as difficult.
Oh, yeah. I mean, where you put the decision-making doesn't change the number of hours it will take, nor the information you need. It's just a question if you're going to do it in every case, and this is written for every case, not only the ones with the 3 out of 5 proven, it's written where there are 5 are proven, and the respondent still thinks the fees are too high. Right?
I understand the argument.
So
yes.
What I'm trying to do is, I totally agree, looking at every case is the absolutely fairest way of doing everything. There's no dispute.
In fact, the whole legal system is a balance between fairness for the individual and uniformity for everyone and efficiency. So my question then is how efficient this is and what will be the increased costs in your time, which is one of the costs, and increased costs in the lawyer's time to do this. I mean, it opens up everything from my perspective.
I understand the question. I perhaps minimized my estimate of time before, partly because as we were working on the rule, we tried to put in elements that would not turn it into a mini hearing. And thinking that it would not turn into that, I was estimating perhaps low. And we won't know until it happens.
Yeah.
But you asked my response, and I gave it to you.
That's right. And what we have heard is it will turn into a mini hearing, and you say it won't. And, of course, we will not know until we're there. I think there has been an increase in challenges to costs since the Connor case. I don't know that, but I'm going to ask OLR to give us those figures. Because my perception, which could be in lieu of nothing.
Thank you. My final sentence, I think, is simply to say that although I have the greatest respect for Keith Soyen and worked with him with great pleasure, I don't believe that OLR's petition really satisfies the court's concerns. It in some way reduces the chilling effect of high costs because it simply lowers the cost for everyone. But it does not begin to address the court's concern, I think, for fairness. It fails to give you any guidance as whether to exercise your discretion or when, still. And I would recommend the bar's proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. Any questions? Thank you. I appreciate you taking your time, and so does the court, in being an administrative law judge and in serving as a referee. And I know you've worked hard with the referees on forms and tests at bench books and a whole variety of things, and education of referees. And having attended some of your meetings, we owe you a debt of gratitude, and I would like to state it here. Are there any other appearances in regard to 05-01? Hearing none, that terminates the hearing on 05-01, and we're going to go right down, no break, right down. The table is set. We're going to talk about these three petitions that we heard, and we're going to try and conclude that hearing promptly so that we can move on to our closed session. It's a bring your own party. Get her.
Those days have gone for both of us, Patrick.
Whatever happened to our beloved Marshall here and her pencils? John, I just stole three of your pencils.
Actually, we've got them up here.
That's to be very clear. Uh-huh. Yeah, I am the marshal. They changed it.
You can take them right off the bench. You shouldn't have to give
them. Okay, so we're starting with...
But I am.
We're starting with Julie, who's going to tell us exactly what to do on all three of these.
0607, right? 0607? 05, 05, 06.